Welcome, everyone. This webinar is on desert foraging, and it's from the Eat Local project, sponsored by the Cochise County Library District in Cochise County. And just a couple Zoom housekeeping details. This is a webinar format, so unless you are one of our presenters, your camera is off and you are muted, so no worries about that. Please use the chat for any discussions you want to have, and several people are just saying where they're here from and whether they've been on an Eat Local webinar. So if you want to put that in the chat, if you're just joining us, we would love to hear, particularly those from outside of Cochise County, how you heard about it. If you have questions for our presenters, you can use the Q&A function or feel free to put questions in the chat as well. And Charlene will help us sort those, as well as bringing over questions from Facebook. Just a little bit about the Eat Local project. I mentioned this is sponsored by the Cochise County Library District, and it's focused on Cochise County, Arizona. And we have, on this foraging webinar, we have people from outside of the area as well, which we welcome. The project is designed to increase awareness of local food options in our area. And we're doing that through a number of different channels. We're doing these webinars every 2 weeks and some other events, which we'll talk about at the end. We'll talk about upcoming events. We have a website, eatlocalcochise.org, where we've put together a directory of local food producers, as well as markets and other locations where you can buy local food here. If you know of other farms or places where local food is being sold, please email us, because we're continuing to build that directory. And that's something we know that people have asked for and are using. We also are sponsoring a big read this month of the book Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver. And there are copies of that book at all of the public libraries in our county. And we also have book club kits. So if you have a group who might be interested in reading that book, you can either contact your local library or contact me through our website. And we would love to facilitate that. We're on Facebook and Instagram. And we also have a school kit for teachers, as well as homeschoolers in the county. So just to introduce our panel, my name is Karen Fassenpower, and I'm the project manager for Eat Local. And I'm going to, as we introduce ourselves, I'm going to ask us to say where we're from, because even in the county, there's a big difference. So I live about 50 miles north of Douglas and about 20 miles southeast, I guess, of Portal. I'm here in the Portal library tonight, and that's the my closest local library. So I'm in a kind of a flat area between the Pelencio and the Chiricahua Mountains, but right at the base of the Chiricahuas, and I have done some foraging in the Chiricahuas, so that mountain environment's a little bit different. We also have with us Christy Brown from Baja Arizona Sustainable Agriculture, BASA. And Christy, you want to say a little bit about where you're located?
Sure. So I live in Sierra Vista, actually outside of town. I'm near Mosin Road, and our property joins with some state land that's between us and 92. So we get a lot of desert. We have a majority mesquite on our property, with some cactus and quite a few cactus. That's about it.
Excellent. Excellent. And we're also happy to have BJ Searcy from BASA with us tonight.
Okay, I'm up in north of Sierra Vista, up in Whetstone, north of Huachuca City, which is a totally different environment than down by Christy and over by Karen. So every time we talk, it's like different countries talking to each other, and I'm sure that everybody else has the same thing. I've been working with BASA for 10 years almost now, or 11 years almost now, with the mesquite and the mesquite milling. So some of you have possibly had your mesquite beans milled, and that's where I've been. You may have seen me before, maybe. We have a new project that's going partly through BAHA, Arizona Sustainable Agriculture, and partly through the Extension Office, and that's food preservation classes. So if anybody wants to get involved with food preservation, you need to contact either myself or Cynthia Aspergen over at the Extension Office, and we will get you scheduled with a class, or if you want a one-on-one training, we could do that. Now that things are opening up, we're hoping to have some actual physical classes, which is really exciting for us to do, because Zoom is kind of hard to do.
Excellent. Thank you. And that reminds me to mention that we also have archive copies of all of our previous webinars. And BJ and Cynthia were with us 2 weeks ago to talk about food preservation in a shorter format. And so that is on the website at eatlocalcochise.org. And then, as she mentioned, there's also a much more in-depth class on pressure canning that's going on that you could contact her about. So we're lucky in this county to have so many different areas and so many different sort of kinds of foraging and things to do. And I was inspired by the BAHA's field guides that we're going to share with you tonight. And I made some desert willow tea today, which was a new thing for me. So I appreciated the prompt to do that. And we're going to start with some background on BASA.
Okay, I think I was going to handle this one. So I didn't realize until I joined the board a few years ago how long the history was. BASA was formed in 2000 with the Bisbee Farmers Market. They had this alliance of farmers, ranchers, and people that were interested in local food. They incorporated as a nonprofit in 2005, and that they hired a hammer mill to mill at the Bisbee Market in 2005. The hammer mill that BASA owns now was purchased in 2010. That's when BJ and her husband were running it. The first milling in Sierra Vista was soon after that. That same director that formed up BASA also managed the Sierra Vista Farmers Market. And then we were at Wilcox and Carmichael in Sierra Vista. So they did form both farmers markets, and we love our farmers market, and then the director managed them initially. Our mission statement is to create and expand local sustainable food systems in Southern Arizona that promote health and well-being of the natural world and the people who live there. So, and I have a general desert foraging tips here that's going to apply to almost every food that we're going to cover tonight that BJ and I will talk about. Always try to pick in a safe area away from any chemicals, toxins. A lot of people really get crazy with Roundup here. Heavy road traffic, construction areas, and chemical sprays seen or unseen. If you see something on private land, always ask first. You know, you could see fruit falling off trees and ask. And public lands if you can, but you can't always, Karen, right? You want to talk Cholla now, BJ?
Okay. The Cholla, which is almost everywhere, but you see a lot of it right now blooming. And for the most part, people think of it as a nuisance weed and it's just a pain in the neck, but it's actually very edible. The blossoms are edible when they come out, but before they bloom, what I found was the buds are absolutely a treat. You use tongs to pick them because they are got a lot of thorns. They really do have a lot of thorns. Pick them with a set of tongs just before they bloom is the best time. Then you get the thorns off. You can take them off with tweezers, which is very time consuming, or you can take a metal screen or fine mesh hardware cloth, rub them over it. What I do is I put a whole bunch of them on there and then put something on top of them, a can or a piece of metal or something, and keep rolling it over, and you'll take off the majority of them, and then there'll only be a few to pluck off. Get all the thorns off, the way that I really enjoy them, you can eat them fresh, but the way that I really enjoy them myself is I blanch them and then pickle them and make a refrigerator pickle out of them. I found that balsamic vinegar works really well with them. You can steam them or blanch them. You can dry them for later use. They're a great little hors d'oeuvre and something that's kind of unique for if you have somebody from other parts of the country, you can feed them something that's locally produced. The blossoms can be used in salads. They can be used in making a tea, or you can make wine with them.
Nice. What do the buds taste like? I saw a picture of them in a quiche.
Yes. They're pretty mild, I think. I made that quiche. I think it could have used a little bit more seasonings, like green chilies or something. So, but yeah, maybe if you just, I don't know, BJ, I'll let you talk here. But I think they would be really good. Just steam them with some butter and salt.
That you can do that with them too. And I have had them that way. Gee, how do you describe the taste of an orange? They taste unique. They really do taste unique, but they're not a bad taste. They're not a harsh taste. They're just a kind of a neat, natural taste. And because it was the first time I tried them, I was kind of wondering, oh my gosh, am I really wanting to do this? And I tried them and I went, wow, that's kind of a neat idea. Then I just had some that were steamed. I didn't have butter or anything on them. And that's a great way to start with it. And you can go, okay, this would really taste good as a pickle. This would really taste good as, it has its own unique taste.
And we have a request in the chat for your recipe of the Choya buds with balsamic.
Actually, it's pretty easy. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever had the Belly Buster pickles with onions and cucumbers. Pretty much the same idea. I use a half and half recipe myself. You can add more or less if you want to. It's kind of by your own taste. I use about a half and half, half water and half balsamic vinegar, and just let them stew for a few days till I remember that I put them in the refrigerator, actually. And then take them and eat them as a side dish. I don't add any other things, just nice. Balsamic vinegar and water.
That sounds good. And then we have another question about, could you talk more about removing the thorns?
Well, it's a trial and error. I heard from somebody else that the best way to take them off was with a screen, with an old window screen. And I looked at the window screens that are on Windows now, and I said, but they're all made out of plastic. But I did find an old metal screen out in the back of the house, and I tried that. And then I found some fine hardware mesh that was even better because it's a little sturdier. And I put probably a cup on the top of it, and took a flat surface, and I found it at a coffee can that was an old metal coffee can, and I just kind of rolled it around on top until the thorns were falling through. It was kind of an amazing thing, and it's a trial and error thing, but the easiest way to do it is by taking most of them off first. Otherwise, you sit there for 45 minutes picking off thorns. There's a lot of little thorns on them, but it's well worth it. It's well worth it. It's a special treat.
And it's sort of like prickly pear too with those thorns. They do soften when they're steamed and cooked, so they're a little easier at that point if that's the route you take. You could be watching TV and pulling thorns, but yeah, I was always afraid I'd miss one and, you know, be eating it. So the steaming will help some.
Anything else on Choya before we go on? Okay, let's talk about yuccas.
Oh, yuccas. I have a lot of those in my area. The picture on the right is actually from a road we walk a lot. This year, they've been very slow here, but I've seen a lot of them in town. So they're either getting more water, and ours are going to be June instead of May. And we get the lower ones because we don't carry a ladder when we're walking. And we just take the flower off when it's fresh and young. Don't eat the middle, but the petals. You can eat them right then. Later on, they will get coated with ants and bees, so be careful. We're morning walkers, so that's a wonderful time to harvest. And then when you bring them home, you can rinse them off, put them in your salads. They'll keep a couple days in the fridge, and or blanch them and freeze them for later. And they could be mixed with greens or other foods. But they really fresh. They have a really nice, sweet and mild flavor is what I call it. You think, do you agree, BJ?
Yep. Yeah, they do. They're not a harsh taste. Mild. The petals are the part that's the most edible, and theoretically you can eat the fruit on them. But I found that the ones that are the soap tree yuccas are very hardcore, and to cook them, you can slice them very thin and cook them and eat them, but they're not as tasty as the banana yucca, which also blooms or is in this area. They're harder to find, but they're a shorter bush and the fruit is shaped like a banana. That's the best way to tell the difference. Whereas the soap tree is like a bulb on it. The blossoms are the most edible part, they're the easiest to find. And a little trick that you can do is pull on it gently. You'll know whether or not the flower has been pollinated. Because if it's been pollinated, the petals will pull right off. If they haven't been pollinated yet, they'll be stuck really hard. The plant knows when it's been pollinated and it drops the blossom, the petals. And you can go along and just pluck out every one of them that's already been pollinated. You can watch a bee go in there, and 5 minutes later, you can pull the petals off faster. I thought it was pretty amazing myself. There's also some recipes that you can use in as a tasty pudding. You can blanch them and use them in all sorts of recipes as a filler. I haven't tried it yet, but I understand you can make brownies and all sorts of other things that by putting the yucca blossoms in and get the nutritional use out of them.
Interesting. So we have a question about why use the petals only. And I've actually eaten the whole flowers, and I don't know if it's just taste and texture or if there's a safety issue.
Taste and texture usually.
Yeah. Okay. So if you'd like to eat the whole flower, go for it.
Right. Make sure the bees are gone though.
and the ants.
Yes. And yeah. Even the desert willow blooms. I was surprised how much bugs there were. But if I just, you know, I put them in a colander and did a quick shake, and that got rid of probably 90% of them. And then I kind of poured them off and then, you know, strain them.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent.
Anything else on yuccas or any other questions we have about yuccas? Okay, we can come back if people have additional questions. And I think what a lot of people are here to hear or learn about is mesquite.
Okay, like I said, I've been actually doing mesquite for about 10 years. And there's actually, I have a little story to go along with it. I had a pot-bellied pig, and he would go along, and we were having to rake up the mesquite beans because he was pigging out, literally, on the mesquite beans. And finally, my husband and I said, well, he really, really loves, they must taste really good. So we took a mesquite bean off the tree and went, oh, this is pretty good. Shortly after that, Valerie McCaffrey, the one that started BASA, was giving a class on cooking with mesquite. They just bought the mill. And since the pig had enjoyed the beans so well, we went to the class and we've just found out that we could participate in some of the milling, and we got hooked. So the first thing that you have to remember is, again, stay away from your highways, toxins, pollutions, and construction stuff. The reason you stay away from highways is because although you can't see it, there is pollution that comes off of the vehicles, and you're using the entire being to make flour with. So if you've got a lot of traffic on a road, the fumes are going to go over and attach themselves to the mesquite beans. You just don't want that. You don't need it. If you go along and you check your trees, and you'll find that you have your favorite trees on your property or wherever you harvest from, some that all have some of the best tasting beans, and you'll have some others that just don't taste good. And if they don't taste good, don't harvest them, because that's what you're going to make the flour out of. If they taste nice and sweet and they're taste a little bit like you've added sugar to them, just break the bean, take a little bite off of it. Watch out, the seed will break a tooth if you bite down really hard on it. So be careful about that. Taste it and find out what kind of bean that's coming off of each tree. Pick it from the tree. Do not pick them up off the ground. Here at my house, I haven't had any signs of aflatoxin, but I have dogs. Do I need to go any further and explain why you don't pick them up off the ground? There's also rodents and every other kind of critter running around. The best thing to do is get them off the tree. There should be dry and brittle. The best thing to do is go along and shake the pot. They come in bundles, little clusters of beans. Shake them. You'll hear the beans rattle. Hold something underneath them, like a bag, a box. I use a trash can lid that's got the kind of sides that let it slide in, and you can pick the beans from there. If you have to tug on them, because they'll still be not quite ripe and sound, you can hear the bean rattling. But if you have to tug on it, they're not quite ready. As soon as you reach up and they just fall off, when you just barely brush them with your hands, they're perfectly ripe. They're perfect. They're dry. They snap easy. Then take them in. They should be dry, brittle, and snap easy, which is why you try not to do that in the rain. Where we live, they don't even get ripe until the monsoon season as a rule. So you're going to have to kind of go by the weather, but they'll still get ripe. There's a Brucia beetle. It's a very tiny beetle. It is not harmful. It's not toxic. It goes along and it lays its eggs in the green bean when it's very tender and soft, right in the seed. And then when the little baby Brucia beetle hatches from its egg, it eats its way out. So you'll see holes in your beans. That's where the Brucia beetles have come out. So that's not a bad thing to see the holes. But you do have to watch, because that will mold real easily because the shell on the bean has been broken. If you want to get rid of the Brucia beetles or kill them in the inside, kill the eggs, you can put them in a oven at about 200 degrees for 1 to 2 hours, or you can put them in a solar dryer or solar oven. Or we had one lady that found out that there was an old car in her backyard, and you know how hot it gets inside of a car that's closed up. She cracked the windows about an inch, and then she put her beans on cookie sheets and put them inside the car. Worked great. She didn't have to get an oven going. She didn't have a solar oven, and that was what she needed to do. Usually they'll hatch out and leave during the heating process. I've never done them in the oven. I usually use a solar dryer or a dehydrator, which is quite easy to do too. That will make them even more brittle and dry. And you want them as dry as they possibly can be. When you break them, they should be a snap, not a crack. It should be a snap. And the reason for that is because when we run the mill, The meal needs to have a very dry bean going through it, or it'll start gumming up the hammers, and your flour will come out damp and clump. It's not a good thing, so just go ahead and have them dry. Right before you get them milled, check them again. And it's always a good idea. That way, if you've got any more Brucia beetles that have hatched out, you can get rid of them. You can sift them. Now, there's different ways of lift different lines of thought. I'm a little OCD, and I still think of the dogs, the bugs, and the birds that have been around the beans. So I rinse my beans before I dry them. It's a quick rinse. It doesn't make them wet. It cleans them. I put them in the sink, run my water over them, fill the sink full just to cover them, drain it, and then I dry them in my solar dryer or my dehydrator just to get rid of any of the last things. So if you are kind of that, I'm not going to do that because it hasn't been cleaned, go ahead and you can clean them. It's very easy to do. Put them in a very clean, dry, food safe container. We usually recommend 5-gallon buckets because it's quite easy to do. Make sure the lid is on tight. There's drying agents that you can put a container of. The easiest one is baking soda. You can put a little container of baking soda in the very top and it will pull out any last minute moisture that is in there. And mesquite flour is gluten-free, so you'll need to use it in conjunction with other flours. That can be your gluten-free flours, your wheat flours, almond flour, any of those things. Those people that have to use a gluten-free diet, if they use the bean flour, it's kind of like eating paste. And that's when I really got started using it for baking cookies and stuff like that, is because my sister had a gluten problem and she tried the gluten-free flours and she said, no, I'm never going to eat a cookie again if it's going to taste like paste. So I made her some mesquite cookies and she was sold on it. It's adds a sweet, woody, nutty taste. It's wonderful. There's a lot of other recipes you can use, pancakes, waffles. There's just no end to the recipes that you can use. I better shut up.
Can I make a comment about the food containers? We do prefer a food safe container. And if you guys are able to go out to restaurants now, you can always ask. Some of our favorite was the, Schlotsky's Deli used to just set their empty pickle buckets out back. Okay, well, they smell like pickle for a little bit, but if you rinse them good with some baking soda and water and let them sit and just leave them out, they're fine. We've seen people bring beans inside of oil containers and some really nasty things. And I just think, you know, it's food. So look at yard sales for large Tupperware, even for storing later. Just check with your restaurants. I mean, if they have buckets, they certainly don't recycle them and probably end up in the dumpster if you don't ask. So Schlotsky's is a good place to ask.
Can either one of you talk more about the milling process? And for people who haven't had mesquite flour, it's not the actual bean that you're eating. It's the pithy part of the bean. It's the thick part inside. So they actually mill the entire bean.
Yes.
And talk more about what that looks like, and then also how people can bring their beans to be milled, how and where.
Well, the picture on the right is an example of buckets that are ready to be milled. And I'll turn it over to BJ more about the hammer mill, but we do check all the pods first because we lay them out on trays like the one in the picture on the right. We don't want rocks in the hammer mill and sticks and leaves. So it's quite a lot of work for us to train our volunteers and to work it every year. But if you do some of the legwork first, you won't be in line very long. lay them out on a tray, lay them out on a old screen, something, because really it is food and the whole pod is going to go in the hammer mill. So people ask too about a gallon of pods will give about a pound of flour. If you can gather from your neighborhood 5 gallons bucket, it costs you $12 to mill it and you'll have about 5 pounds of flour. That lasts most people all year, even with some sharing that we might do, you know, so that would be plenty. Yes, with the whole pod goes into the hammer mill and what comes out is flour and then the chaff. And the chaff is looks like oatmeal. It's all the stuff that doesn't go through. So yeah. I think once you start, you kind of get hooked, right, BJ?
Yes. Yeah, you do. And you can take your favorite recipes. It doesn't take special recipes. You can take your favorite recipes, and the recipes that we have usually available are recipes that we've taken. Chocolate chip cookies, for an example, that's the one I started with. And you substitute a portion of mesquite flour for regular flour. I think we started with, I usually start with a quarter of what it calls for. So if it calls for a cup of flour, I put a quarter of mesquite flour and 3/4 of regular flour. If it holds up really well, I may try going it up to 1/3 of a cup. And there's a few recipes that actually you could go up to half and half, but you may need to add another agent. But the cookie recipes, I found if I threw in an extra egg into the recipe, it held together quite nicely. And it is addicting because you find out that the recipe that you've used for waffles for years is all of a sudden really a totally different recipe. We found pie crusts. I tried it in a pie crust recipe, so substituted a quarter of it. I think it's a quarter of it. The recipe for with mesquite flour. Pie crusts are notoriously not flavored. And with pie crust with mesquite, you have a flavor added to it. So you add it to your pumpkin pie or your apple pie, and you've got a nutty flavor that just never used to be there. My husband just won't eat a pie that's not made with mesquite pie crust anymore.
So let me go back to the actual milling process, Karen. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And that is done in October. Usually on a good summer, yeah, we'll be getting mesquite beans all summer. So we schedule those, and next week we'll meet and set our dates. And we also invite people that would like to volunteer to help to come. So we'll set a training date, and we mill at each market, Bisbee Market, wherever it is, and Sierra Vista Market. The whole day long we're there, and you'll come in, sign in, we'll check over your pods. If you want to go shopping while we mill, you can leave. You're in a queue, we number you and line up the buckets, and then, or you can wait and hang out. So we're tentatively thinking of doing Bisbee first, probably about the third Saturday or something, right, BJ, approximately, but they'll be on our webpage, they'll be on our Facebook, and the links to that are all on our webpage, and we have a web blog also. Plus, we're at the market once or twice a month with our flyers, and then we'll have those printed out, and you can stick them on your fridge so you can get home and put it on your calendar. We also coordinate with Desert Harvesters and the Mesquite Stewards, and so there's milling events also in Phoenix, right, BJ? And then
right.
A couple of them in Tucson in June at Mission Gardens on June 26th. Desert Harvesters is also doing one at Las Milipitas in November. And then the Mesquite Stewards in Patagonia, they have the original Cascabel hammer mill. And last year they milled in November also, not last year, but the year before. No, last year. Oh, I guess they didn't. Whenever, pre-pandemic. they milled the same weekend we were helping at Desert Harvesters. So, but we're all going to coordinate. I mean, more opportunities, even if you have to travel. I mean, there's lots of opportunities to have your flour milled.
It's really a great, it's a great service that BASA offers to have that hammer mill and do that, and to do, to be able to do it locally and not have to go to Tucson or Phoenix is fantastic. Becca mentions in the chat that if you have a small mountain, you want to try it. And people often ask about this, can you grind it at home? And I do know people who've done it either in a coffee or a spice grinder or a blender like a Vitamix, but I would be careful because the beans are hard. And so, you know, don't use something that you're going to ruin. And even when you do it that way, it's not as the same as a hammer mill. So you're going to get chunks and you'll probably have to sort of sift it out. But that is a way to try it. And then also there are places you can get pre-ground mesquite flour. Christy Boss is selling some of that.
Yes. Sometimes we have flour BJ's at the Sierra Vista market on the first Thursday. I go to both Bisbee and Sierra Vista, but later in the month, usually, it can go very quickly. We encourage you to try a half pound or a pound first, but we don't do the big commercial millings. There really is a need for it to be available at the food co-op and lots of restaurants to have it. But yes, definitely you can sample it. You can sample cookies made with it. And BJ and I always usually have cookie samples with recipes. So
stop by and see them at the market. High Desert Market occasionally has mesquite flour. They had it earlier this year and they haven't had it the last couple of times I've been in there. When we had Gary Nabham on, he is quite the advocate for mesquite. And he talked about that he thinks there's a market for somebody to get into this in a bigger commercial way. He talked about a few restaurants that are buying mesquite flour from, I believe, Latin America, South America, somewhere. So if someone's looking for a new venture, that might be something to think about. We have a couple other questions in the chat. One is about nutritional benefits. Is it high in fiber? And I know it has, it's very good for low glycemic. Again, Gary talked a lot about it's good for people who are diabetic, and it's also, because it's that slow release sugar, you can eat less. And I know for like, it releases over time. Other comments on nutrition?
Yeah, Karen, you can send that out later. The standard nutrition info that we give to people at the market is, we can send that to you.
Yeah.
And you put that in your follow-up.
It's extremely high in protein. It's considered a legume, and it's one of the highest protein legumes that you could find. The glycemic index is 25 for those of you that are watching, because regular flour is at 100 and mesquite flour is at 25. So yes, it's a very nutritious. There's a few other things that, without having it in front of me, there's some antioxidants in it that are not found normally just in other flours.
And we will send out it on the BASA website. There's a nutritional guide and we'll send that out. There was a question specifically about how many carbs. So we will, we'll try to send that information out. A request to repeat when the pods are usually ready to harvest. August, September, September, October.
Actually, it varies. Mm-hmm. I may be getting them a month ahead of Hereford, and sometimes they're ahead of me. It's one day they're green and they start turning yellow, and then all of a sudden you're harvesting. There are other parts of the county that have not even gotten their beans past the green stage yet when I'm done with my harvest. So it starts sometime in June, maybe. I've got lots of beans right now, and it looks like they by the end of the month, I'll be harvesting. Sometimes we'll even have two harvests. And I think since I've been playing with it, there was one year we had three full harvests. So
wow.
depending on the year and the location and your microclimate, there's
So look at your beans, wait for them to get dry, and so you can snap them, and they'll be real dry. And I would say, you know, if you want to do this, really watch your beans, because once they dry, the animals love them. So if you're like, I'm in an area where we have a lot of open ranging cattle, and they go fast, and even the wood rats, and everybody loves mesquite beans because they're nutritious and delicious and fairly easy to get to and pick. So if you want to pick them, watch for when they're ready, because they won't. And it depends on the year. So last year, at least where I was, we had a really low mesquite year. There just weren't a lot of beans. This year, the blooms were so thick, and already I can see we have just so much beans. It seems like it's the best year in 10 years or so that I've been watching. So I think it varies.
The other thing you have to watch for is when the monsoon starts, sometimes they blow in really hard. The wind will come in, and if your beans are almost ready, the next day when you walk out there, they're all going to be on the ground. We have told people in the past to lay down a tarp, a sheet, and then if you go gather them up right away, and like BJ said, take them into the sink, pick out the best ones and rinse them off. Those are certainly usable. You can actually lose, you know, 50% of your pods in one bad windstorm with rain. So the thing is, you got to get on them quickly.
And that's true with anything you forage, right? It doesn't last.
Right. And the one thing that we always watch for, and for some reason, it's hard to get people to understand, there's a black mold that shows up on the beans. You can see it more predominantly on the light colored ones, but it does show up on the purple beans too. And there's no real difference in the purple beans than the light brown ones in taste. It's from tree to tree. I've had some really good purple ones. I've had some really good brown ones. I can't say that there's a difference, but the mold is mold. You don't want to eat mold. You don't want to put mold in your flour. So if you find mold on you can break off that portion of the bean that has the mold on it and throw it away. And that's one of the things that we're watching for. Or you can throw away the entire bean if it's completely black. You don't want to save it. And don't try to scrape it off. You dispose of that part because the mold goes below the surface.
Right.
Don't want to eat mold.
And again, that's going to depend on your specific area and also the weather. I would say, you know, we don't see mold on our beans where I am, and it's just so dry. And I don't dry them in the oven either. So I will do a quick rinse, but I usually don't dry them in the oven. But another question from the chat. Is the primary reason to harvest and mill mesquite beans low cost, nutrition, or novelty? And I would say we should each answer this, because I think it depends on your own situation. For me, I love the taste, and I like that it's a sweet, it's a way to sweeten something without a lot of processed sugar. So I use mesquite flour a lot in things like banana bread and any kind of quick bread. And I substitute part of the flour, but I also drop a lot of the sugar because it's a sweetened flour that's more nutritious.
The reason that I started doing it was basically because of the pot-bellied pig. And then my sister had her gluten problem. But what was kind of amazing is I started doing all my baking with mesquite flour. My husband is diabetic, and he went from having 2 insulin shots a day to not needing insulin for a period of time after he'd been doing nothing but eating he still had diabetes, but it was under control with the diet. So I'd say the nutrition was probably my primary thing, and why I still do a lot of baking with mesquite.
Okay. And I will say that we are about sustainability, and you know, we're in dry years. It's really tough to garden here, but people lived here for thousands of years, and they were hunter-gatherers, and there's so much to gather that's what we want to tell you about. Once I went to my first milling with BJ and her husband, I mean, I got hooked, and I love it. I like to add it to my diet. I like to share it with others, and so it's good for you, but it's the economics of doing it yourself. You're we charge $14, $15 a pound. You can mill yourself for about $2 a pound. So you collect, you bring it to us, and you have a reasonable food product. I mean, specialty flours are very expensive, you know, and if you do have diabetes or you have gluten-free people in your life, it's just the way to go. But the sustainability is important that we realize the food that's around us that is just going to waste.
Absolutely. I've talked to several people this year who are seeing that the mosquito is going to be just crazy this year. And for people who have animals, some of them are harvesting it for animal fodder. And then one other way that I've used mosquitoes, made a syrup with it that I really liked. And it doesn't require milling. And I really did it. I did it last year as an experiment to think about what, you know, what there is as a sugar substitute, because it's really, you know, I know people who've experimented with sorghum and stuff, and it's tough to grow and it's tough to process into anything. And I really liked the syrup. I thought that was a good way to go. There's one more question in the chat and then we should probably move on, but this is a question about the aflatoxin danger if there's a heavy monsoon. How do you avoid that? And for people who aren't familiar with that, what is that and how much of a concern is it? Gary talked a little bit about having an experience with that left him sick for a couple of days.
Yeah. The only aflatoxins we've had around that we know in this southeastern Arizona is up at Tucson. We had ours tested at different milling places, at different harvesting places. And they didn't find any signs of it. It is a toxin. It's usually found when they pick it up off the ground. If we just don't pick it up off the ground, then we just avoid it, and then there's no problems. That's probably the biggest rule of thumb, is that there's stuff on the ground. One of them is aflatoxins, besides the fact that you have dogs. So, yeah, it is a toxin. We did have our flowers tested for several years in a row, that they wanted to see if there was any toxins. In Cochise County didn't have any show up in any of their beans. Tucson was the only place that they'd found any.
Great. That is excellent information to have. Anything else on mesquite before we go on? Okay, let's talk about prickly pears.
Oh, this is my one. I love prickly pear, but we all do. They do ripen. We have many, many varieties here. I think 23 in the book I was talking about. Some do ripen early in July. One friend called me and said, my neighbor's not here. They're gone. And there's tons of them. Christy, the birds are eating them. So we've had a lot of nice blooms on the fruits. I've seen fruits starting to set. And so then Christy always puts her bucket, tongs, and gloves in the car. You can walk intentionally and look for them in deserts. Washes tend to have a lot. And we talked about whether we're going to give away our favorite locations, but start looking around. They're going to be ready next month. Have the leather gloves because of the abundance of stickers. Get some of those long-handled barbecue tongs, a big bucket. You can use a bag, but then there's a lot of thorns. They should pull off really easy, and you should see a little red tag where it's left. I went to get some over by this old school admin office, and there's several varieties there. Some of them were not ready. They did not pull easily. There was no tag, and I came back 2 weeks later, and they were fine. When you get those home, get a big colander and rinse them off really good. You'll get a lot of needles will come off then in the rinsing. Let them drain. And then once again, my trick to the easiest way I found to use them was to freeze them. And then they just turn into soft mush, and then you can, you know, deal with them at that point. You can also put them right into a pan and steam them and start cooking them up for jellies, syrups, juice, whatever. They will keep about a week or two. I wouldn't leave them much longer than that. If you have a really cool spot to store them in that bucket once they've been rinsed off. But I definitely take a good spray into them when I get home. There might be ants and bird droppings and other things on them. Should go on to the next slide. And there's a Prickly Pear Cookbook by Carol Needhammer. And she has actually modified from her original recipes. A lot of them now have a lot less sugar. What I like about just throwing them in a tub in the freezer is when they come out, they're soft. I'm reading off the slide now. You can mash them real easy. A blender is a safe place to use them now because they won't tear it up. And then pour them through a cheesecloth or a nice clean pillowcase works really good too. And then you're gonna end up with juice. And so then you would follow the recipes for the right amount of juice to make, add sugar and follow directions, right, Michael? And then your jelly. I've made a lot more syrup than jelly. And then, or you can freeze it at that point too. So cooking is tedious after it. Let's say you're gonna try some just syrup or jelly. You gotta let them cool really a long time and settle before you start trying to squeeze them through a bag because they're gonna be really hot. But they will come pretty much all summer. I've harvested here from July to November. I mean, around Veterans Day is when I finally quit. So it is wonderful to put prickly pear syrup on your mesquite pancakes. And it's really good in margaritas. And BJ and I both make wine with it. It makes delicious wine, which our wine is really simple, just the juice, sugar, yeast. There's none of those evil stuff that they put in at the store, but maybe some yeast enhancers or stuff. And lemonade, Karen, there's a ton of recipes. It can also, I mean, in some cultures, they just cut them open and eat them, you know, they scrape the thorns off and it's fresh fruit, you know.
Yeah. Now what I do to on the red ones and on the thornless ones, which are orange fruits, I'll take a pair of tongs and a little burner and cook off the thorns, which is another way to do it. That way you can get them all. Then I cut them open and get the fruit out of it and then do the straining stuff. I just, besides after the washing, I do the scoop it out with a spoon. I actually use a grapefruit spoon, so it's really easy to do because it's got the serrated edge. And there's another recipe that we have on our table that is for a barbecue sauce that you add no sugar to. It's the barbecue, it's the prickly pear, it's got a chili sauce in it, and it's got unsweetened apple concentrate, frozen concentrate, that you use for a sweetener. So you have no sugar, so if you've got somebody that's diabetic and you want to use it, that's great. Another thing that you can do that is kind of unique and it's really a crowd pleaser is to take some of the prickly pear juice, put it in to a small container. I like a yogurt dish or something, so it makes a fairly good size ice cube. Freeze it up, then put about a cup sized ice cube in a gallon of water. Let it dissolve and serve it. People love that kind of drink because it's not harsh. It's a really good, refreshing summer drink. I've entertained quite frequently, and I'll use the orange ones in one jar and I'll use the red ones in another jar and come out with all sorts of compliments on the different wonderful flavor of the prickly pear water. It's mostly water. People think it's great. And each prickly pear has a different taste. The red ones taste one way, the orange ones taste a little bit different. And if you really patient and maybe just a little weird, you can find a lot of the other prickly pears that have a nice firm fruity kind of thing. That I have one that's in my yard that's a little polka dot one that has a berry the size of the tip of your thumb, but I've cleaned them out and it tastes like lemon or lime. It's a citrusy taste. So
cool. And your steamer, Karen, you should talk about that.
Yes. If you just want the juice and you don't want the actual pulpy fruit or the seeds, I love the steam juicers. And they're a big, I can show a picture if people are interested, but it's a big pot that has multiple layers. So the bottom layer you put water in, and then it has a big steam basket. And you can use it for anything, but the reason I like it for prickly pears is you don't have to deal with the stickers. You put the whole tunas right in there, stickers and all. You boil the water, put a lid on, and it takes maybe 20 minutes. And out of the bottom of the steam juicer is a rubber tube. And then just the clear, beautiful, it's the most beautiful color, prickly pear. The magenta juice comes pouring out and you just put, you know, mason jars under it and keep filling them. And you kind of, at the end, you kind of mash in the basket to get the end of the juice. But it is the easiest way that I've found to really deal with this. And my day I start looking for this is Labor Day, where I am. Labor Day is about when we start, and we usually just do one big harvest. But like Christy said, when they pull off, you know, get your metal tongs, and when they pull off easy, you'll see they're all pulpy and just beautiful. And again, they don't last forever because the critters like to eat them too. Mm-hmm. Other comments or questions about prickly pears? Let me see if I can jump and show this.
You have to watch for the critters around the plants too, you know, rattlesnakes and rodents. But I was over by the wash off 92 there, Garden Canyon Wash. And as I had my bucket, and it was later in the day, and all of a sudden I looked down and there was a fox laying in the under the prickly pears. There was a clearing area, and he stood up, and I went, "It's okay, I just want some fruit." And then he laid back down and went back to sleep. He stayed there the whole time I was picking in the area.
That's beautiful.
He's beautiful. Beautiful.
We get a lot of javelinas around our prickly pear, so we watch. But that's a lovely side benefit of foraging, is it gets you out in areas that you might not normally be and seeing things. When I was out getting desert willow blooms, I stumbled across a pair of horned lizards, just big, fat, beautiful ones that I wouldn't have seen if I wouldn't have been out there picking the blossoms. So that's nice. So we're winding down on our time. This is a picture of the steam juicer for people who are interested in seeing that. And you can, if you're interested in this, in some, you know, we loan ours out because there's really only just a couple times a year we use it. So you might ask around if people have one. You can also get them on eBay or places used pretty inexpensively. Other questions or thoughts before we kind of go to a wrap up?
Okay, there's a lot of other things that you can forage, and that's just barely scratching the surface. You should never starve in the desert. The pads on the prickly pear, you scrape them off, cut them up. You can cook them. You can eat them fresh in a salad, although they're a little gummy. There's a mucus kind of thing. So that I've had them breaded and air fried, which was the first time I'd had anything air fried was a prickly pear pad. There's also your purslane and your jewels of opar and all sorts of other greens. I have a really good friend who said that her husband made her stop telling people that for the people that they invited over, that she was making weed salad, because she'd go out in the yard and she'd just pick everything that was growing wild. And she said, okay, well, we'll just talk about it being foraged salad. So now she has, it's forage salad and they think it's wonderful. She calls it weed salad to sell it. And it is, it's all sorts of, your tumbleweeds, when they're young, they're great. You can put them in a salad.
Even pigweed, I know people, when it's really young, people eat and.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a totally edible plant that it, when they're young, you, the leaves and stems are edible. The roots are always edible as a,
warm and tea.
Cooked and eaten. And then with it, once it's gone to seed, you get amaranth from the grain, from the seeds.
Yeah, amaranth is a big marketable thing. And here we call that same amaranth plant pigweed. And we some of us don't like it too much, but yeah. So that's pigweed or amaranth we're talking about. And then the other thing that Christy mentioned was Mormon tea, which is the ephedra. The looks like long pine needles, thick pine needles that they, there's a lot of things they make into teas. And then we didn't really talk about berries. There's not, you know, in the real lower desert, we don't have a lot of berries, but a lot of people and they are in Cochise County, mulberries right now. We've actually harvested mulberries already. We're kind of just at the very end of it, but you look around for mulberries. In the mountains, you can find raspberries, elderberries and other kinds of mountains, but at berries, but at a higher elevation. So lots of good things. We're going to talk about some books and places you can get more information. Let me just bring that up right now. So we have a lot of books in our county library system, and we've added some recently on foraging. I think a really good guide to this that many of us use is John Slattery's Southwest Foraging book. And we have a lot of copies in that of that in different branches of the library. So definitely look for that. And then these are all other books that are available through our county library system. And if you haven't, you can order these books from any branch and have them delivered to your branch. So ask your librarian. And Christy tells
us. And Vasa sells this book too, you know that.
Yes.
So we give our members a discount on it if you join us and mill with us. And then otherwise we sell it to benefit desert harvesters, the ones that made the book.
Awesome. And this, the book in the bottom right-hand corner, Cacti of the Southwest, I wasn't aware of that book, and Christy had recently gotten a copy, and it's really, really comprehensive.
Beautiful.
That's a good one too. Any other questions that we've missed, Charlene, as we're wrapping up? And people can also feel free to email or
you've covered everything that I have seen go by.
Great. We do have I'm sorry.
Harvesting guides are available too.
Yes, I forgot to mention that. The links were in the chat, but they're really, these are harvesting guides for spring and summer that BASA has developed that are great. So those links were in the chat. They're on the BASA website, and we will also, on the Eat Local Cochise page, we'll post those and we'll send them with the archive. Everybody who registered for the webinar will get an email with the archive, but I know sometimes that goes into people's spam folders. So keep an eye out for that or check in at either our Facebook page or eatlocalcochise.org.
Oh, Karen, they're not on the web page yet. We're still working on a web page, but they're on the Facebook page. You can follow the links from the web page, and I put them up there.
Perfect.
Plus, we'll have them with us at the markets if you want.
Great. Do you know when is the next time you'll be on at the market?
Tomorrow.
Oh, great! Excellent. And
I should be there the third Thursday, and you'll be there tomorrow, right?
And I will be there tomorrow as well. That's the Sierra. So the Sierra Vista Market, for people who don't know, is every Thursday from 10 to 2, and Bisbee is every Saturday. So look for BASA and all of us there. 2 weeks from tonight, we have a webinar on raising local livestock and in sustainable ways, and we'll be talking with two local ranchers about the benefits and how they raise livestock. We are going, I mentioned that we have our big read of Barbara Kingsolver's book this month. We'll have an online discussion of that book, which will just be an informal discussion on Zoom 4 weeks from today on June 30th. And then there are a couple specific events related to foraging that the Sierra Vista Community Garden is sponsoring. One is on June 12th with Christy, and that's a talk on foraging. And then on July 24th, Mimi Camp is going to lead a mountain foraging walk. So those are things, again, that's through the Sierra Vista Community Garden. We will post that on our page as well. And we have a question to see the book page again. So here are the books. And then also the Eat Local Project is in the process of announcing and scheduling and announcing a couple celebrations of eating local, which will be events that will be held this summer. And the first one of those will be at the Elfrida Library on Friday, July 23rd. And we're excited. And Basa will be at that along with other people. And we're excited about, we're going to have kid activities and just a lot of different things going on at that. So look for more information on that as we get into the summer. Again, you can always email us or ping us on either Facebook or Instagram, or call any of your local library branches and get more resources and information. So thank you so much to Christy and BJ for being with us tonight. And thank you to all of you, and watch for future events. And we look forward to talking with you more.